Welcome to Physics and Religion, a series of podcasts exploring the interaction between modern science and traditional religion, mostly Christianity. I am your host, Dr. Albert Stets. We have been dealing with a legacy of René Descartes. Descartes held that there were two kinds of substances, he called it, mind and body. For obvious reasons, this point of view is called dualism. The mind can exist outside the body and has no physical properties such as mass and location. It can think, the body cannot. The mind can control the body, but the body can also control the mind, as for example, when one does something out of passion. This seemed plausible at first, but we were at a loss to explain how something completely non-physical could interact with something purely physical. We are forced back, at least for the time being, to monism, the idea that there is only one kind of substance. So, what will it be, mind or body? I would like to start with a less promising of the two, mind. Nothing physical exists. Reality is purely mind. In fact, my mind. My mind is all that exists. The physical world is pure illusion. You are only an illusion, and all the evidence I have of your existence is illusory. This is a philosophy called solipsism. Incidentally, Bertrand Russell told of a woman who wrote to him announcing that she was a solipsist and wondered why there were not more people like her. Can you refute solipsism? I think not. Any evidence you might bear on the subject is, after all, pure illusion. So, why are you not a solipsist? I presume you aren't. If the theory cannot be proved wrong, then it must be true. Is that not so? I would like to assert an important philosophical principle. If a theory cannot be proved wrong under any circumstances, then, for the same reason, it cannot be taken seriously. The most powerful theories are vulnerable. They constantly submit themselves to disproof. The more often they survive meaningful attempts to refute them, the more we consider them relevant and true. We will have recourse to this principle in coming lectures. So, if we cannot take seriously the proposition that the one substance is mind, then we have to settle with the proposition that everything is physical. Among philosophers, the notion that everything is physical is called, not surprisingly, physicalism. Like many things in philosophy, this seems clear and intuitive enough until one starts to think about it. In fact, many alternative definitions of physicalism have been proposed and disputed, and the disputes involve a host of subtle technical issues. One way to narrow the field is to define reductive physicalism, which holds that all phenomena can be reduced to physics. Parenthetically, this leaves open the possibility of non-reductive physicalism, but this is widely considered to be a logically inconsistent position. Philosophers will now quibble about the exact meaning of the word reduced. But the following example should help. Quantum mechanics, in principle, gives a complete description of atoms and their interactions. Their interactions include binding with other atoms to make molecules. In this sense, chemistry is reduced to physics. The physicalist is committed to the notion that in the same way, biology can be reduced to chemistry, and perhaps even that psychology and sociology can be reduced to biology. Certainly, consciousness can be reduced to neurobiology. An alternative point of view is called emergentism, the belief that there are emergent properties. A property of a system is said to be emergent if it is a new outcome of some other properties of the system and their interactions, while it is, itself, unexpected and different from them. Emergent properties are not identical with, reducible to, or deducible from the other properties. Take, for example, of snowflakes. It is said that no two are identical. It is obviously out of the question to predict the structure of every flake that has ever fallen. On the other hand, one could deduce from the molecular structure of water that it would crystallize in a hexagonal structure. In that sense, the phenomenon of snowflakes is reducible to the properties of water. But is the same thing true of DNA? Given the properties of carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen atoms, could one anticipate the double helix? Beyond that, could one anticipate the emergence of life? The standard emergentist answer to those questions is probably not, and certainly human consciousness is an emergent property, not reducible to the physiology of the brain. Emergentists come in several varieties, however. One issue has to do with downward causation. Assume, for the moment, that DNA is an emergent phenomenon. The properties of the constituent atoms certainly have an effect on the structure of the DNA molecule. But is the reverse true? Do mitosis and meiosis affect the properties of carbon atoms? Obviously not. There is upward causation. Causation from lower-level systems to upper-level systems, but not the reverse. With consciousness, the question is trickier. Do our conscious lives affect the structure of our brains, or is consciousness sort of a useless adjunct to our mental functions? The doctrine that there is no downward causation in this sense is called epiphenomenalism. The usual examples that philosophers give to illustrate epiphenomena are the rainbow that forms over a waterfall and the steam that comes out of a train whistle. The rainbow has no effect on the waterfall, and the steam has no effect on the train. Is it true that our consciousness has no effect on the physiology of our brains? The position at first seems untenable. For example, I am now thinking about lunch. Later today, I will remember thinking about lunch. This memory must be stored somewhere in the biochemistry of my synapses. How could it be otherwise? The committed epiphenomenalist would reply that I am simply confusing cause and effect. My brain cells were thinking about lunch and storing the memories. All this just happened to bubble up into my consciousness. A stronger argument can be made from the existence of aesthetic pleasure. We can enjoy the sight of a beautiful landscape, or the sound of a great symphony, or the words of a poem heard in your head. All this involves conscious perception. Without consciousness, there would be nothing left. Even this argument is not concluded. The validity of epiphenomenalism has been strenuously debated with a wide range of subtle arguments. There are no knockdown arguments for either camp, but my sense is that it is like solipsism in the sense that it is logically constituted in such a way that it cannot be refuted and thus cannot be taken seriously. A second issue that divides emergentists has to do with the nature of supervenience. This is a difficult and controversial term, but one definition accessible to the non-philosopher is this: A supervenes on B. If it is the case that once God created B, A would follow automatically. In fact, she couldn't do anything to prevent A. If consciousness does not supervene on neurobiology, or to put it figuratively, if the mind doesn't supervene on the brain, there must be something about the nature of reality that is over and above the laws of physics. With this in mind, let's look at some of the arguments that have been advanced against physicalism to see if there is some room for that over and above. The first argument has to do with zombies. We discussed zombies in connection with dualism. Let us bring them back from the dead and see how they reflect on physicalism. Your philosophical zombie would look like you in every respect. It would be identical to you in every atom of every cell in your body, except that it has no consciousness. To the extent that such a creature is logically conceivable, there must be something over and above physiology that is responsible for consciousness. The next problem for physicalism is called the inverted spectrum argument, but I'm sure you can construct many different versions of the same argument. Suppose there's someone, not a zombie this time, but an ordinary human being, whose color receptors are inverted in such a way that what we see as red, he or she sees as green, and so forth. There is no way we could tell that this person was in any way different from the rest of us. We would look at a rose and say, "This is a red rose." Our hypothetical color-inverted person would agree. "Yes," she would say, "this is a red rose." Of course, it looks green to her, but she has learned that the color of the rose is named red. There is no way we could ever resolve the difference. So far as I know, my color spectrum is inverted relative to yours. This means there must be something to conscious perception that is beyond the range of physics-based knowledge.